WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Ramon Lopez with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, February the 18th. From Sarasota to Orlando and Miami, Floridians are joining a national wave of protests against Elon Musk and Donald Trump. Organized by grassroots groups, they are reminding Americans that democracy is not a commodity to be bought and sold. The wave of protests comes as the Republican president is moving to purge the federal bureaucracy with thousands of layoffs inside widespread departments. At Bayfront Park in downtown Sarasota on Monday afternoon, a vocal demonstration drew hundreds of protesters. Support came from local organizations, including Save Our Schools, a nonpartisan group that has been vocal at Sarasota school board meetings, and another demonstration is scheduled Tuesday evening at the Sarasota School Board headquarters to protest Trump's proposal to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. Red tide spoiled outings to Sarasota and Manatee beaches on Monday, President's Day, and dead fish covered many beaches over the long Valentine's Day weekend. Visitors avoided close encounters with Gulf waters that reeked of red tide. The bloom had largely stayed near the Collier and Lee County areas since the start of 2025, but slowly drifted towards Sarasota over the past week. Many tourists visiting Siesta Key, Lido Key, Longboat Key, and Anna Maria Island have noted respiratory issues. Finally, Trader Joe's is trading less as canned tuna sold at the popular grocery store has been recalled over botulism risks due to faulty packaging that could compromise safety. And Trader Joe's is limiting the number of eggs customers can buy to 1 dozen per customer per day because of a shortage caused by the avian flu. This has been Ramon Lopez with your WSLR headlines for Tuesday, February the 18th.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 56 of our changing environment. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm Jenna Miller, and this show is being broadcast on February 18th, 2025. Today's programming on WSLR is proudly sponsored by Jim and Patty Richards, celebrating Sarasota's creative community. We thank them for their generous support in keeping independent community radio alive and thriving.
Today we're talking with Rob Wright, who's the conservation chair of Sarasota Audubon.
The views, comments, and opinions that come from our interview shows and on-air personalities and from our calling guests are uncensored, and those views and opinions can be widespread and extremely diverse. The opinions or views expressed by Sam do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WSLR, our staff, or volunteers.
Rob, you've been so involved over the years with Sarasota's environment. We'll get to your work with Audubon, but let's start with your years working for Sarasota County. How and when did that start?
Yes, I originally started working with Sarasota County back in 1978. Mm. I was working with the Department of Health at that time in their water program, mm-hmm. dealing with drinking water. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Tallahassee for 10 years and came back and started working with the county again in 1998.
So you grew up in Sarasota County, is that right?
Yes, I did. I'm a proud Nokomis boy.
All right. So we don't, those are getting harder to come by. So congratulations.
Well, thank you.
So what were you doing when you came back back to Sarasota?
Well, when I came back to Sarasota, I went back to work with Sarasota County. And I was in the Water Resource Division. And it was very interesting because I was dealing primarily with wastewater at that time. And over my career, really, I've been involved with wastewater, stormwater, public drinking water, swimming pools. If it was wet, I probably had something to do with it.
Wow. Are you thinking of writing a book? Sarasota's water?
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Very few people are familiar with all those aspects of it and how they're interrelated.
Well, that's one of the benefits, I think, over the years, that I've had the opportunity to put my two cents worth in on all of those items, because I do have a background in them. So it's worked out pretty well. But when I came back to the county, initially, as I said, I was working with the water resource section and primarily dealing with stormwater and primarily wastewater at that time. And then I was approached by our division director, Teresa Connor, who asked me if I would be interested in heading up a new program that she had thought of. And I asked her what it was, and she said, we're going to call it the Neighborhood Environmental Stewardship Team. And I said, so how many people do I have on my team? She said, you're it. And I said, so what exactly is this going to be all about? And she said, well, we have a lot of county properties where we are doing, you know, removing invasive plants and doing various other things on the properties to make them more environmentally friendly. And we're getting a lot of flack from neighborhoods who abut them, who are thinking that we're going in there and tearing up all the trees. And your job is going to be to meet with them and let them know what we're really doing, and hopefully get them to become interested in what's happening on that property and be interested in coming out and helping plant some, you know, native plants and that kind of thing. So I took up that task, and it was enjoyable. And after probably 6 months or so, I went back to Teresa and I said, you know, why are we only limiting this expertise to folks who live beside county property? And she said, well, what's your idea? And I said, well, why don't we just open it to anybody in the county? And that's how the NEST program really started to flourish. We were open to anyone who needed information on environmental issues. If they were having issues with the plants that they were planting, not growing, if they couldn't figure out what to plant, you know, in under shady oak trees, if they were having issues with stormwater erosion of their stormwater ponds, or issues with the water quality in the stormwater ponds. Those were all things that I was pretty much the lead person for. And of course, the other part that I always enjoyed was that when something would come up at the county that was not in specifically in somebody else's bailiwick, they would go, oh, well, let's see if Rob can take care of that. So I was kind of a jack of all trades from that perspective.
So it sounds like you must have been working with the that must have interacted with the extension people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we worked together quite a bit. And again, just all of the staff I worked with, our maintenance crews, as far as one of the things that we worked on, which was really enjoyable, was the way things were working at that time was that the maintenance crews along our canals were cutting the grass very, very short, because that way they didn't have to do it again so soon. And that was creating erosion. And so the erosion would happen, all of the material would wash downstream, they would go down with dump trucks and a digger, dig up all the material that had washed downstream, put it in a dump truck, take it back up to where it came from, stuff it back onto the banks, and that would be that. And so it was very interesting, because we had kind of a group of people, citizens as well as staff, who sat down and we said, first off, if we grow the grass longer, the root system will hold the soil better and you won't have so much erosion. And secondly, if you're looking to not mow it as often, how about we plant things that are supposed to grow there, native plants, and just let them grow? So that worked out pretty well. We did some projects down in South Venice. And the other part that I always found interesting is that I never realized this, but we often would use labor from the sheriff's department for planting plants and that kind of thing. And they would be all the folks who, you know, would be not really, you know, I would say criminals. I would say people who, for whatever reason, got into a little bit of trouble and didn't want to spend their time in the jail. So they would come out on these work crews. And one of the work crews that I was working with was very interesting because we really did a tremendous job. And at the end of the day, I asked the guys, I said, why did you guys work so hard on this project? And they said, well, because you're different than the other people that we worked with before. I said, in what way? And he said, well, you're the first guy we've ever had who's been the boss who actually worked with us. And when we saw that what you were doing, if it was important enough for you to work at, and you told us what we were doing and why we were doing it, they said, we wanted to put in our fair share. And I said, well, that's one of the biggest compliments I've ever received in my life.
Yeah, that's a great story. So you must have ended up, how many different homeowner associations do you think you worked with?
Oh, I would say probably at least 20 in the county.
Yeah. So I want to tell you a legend. I think I've told you this. I think I've said this on air previously. And you can tell me if it's completely true, somewhat true, might be true, or completely not true and made up. And what I heard was that there was a homeowner association that had retention ponds, stormwater ponds, and that they had been told that they were required to leave littoral vegetation. There was supposed to be a buffer between from the water's edge up to where the lawn started. And that one guy had moved down here, and he was really nervous or afraid that there were alligators lurking in this vegetated area beyond his lawn. So he went to the homeowner association and said, look, could I just mow down to the water's edge so I don't have to be worried about alligators lurking there? And they said, no, Swift Mud and the county and everybody's told us that we need to have a vegetated buffer. You're not allowed to do that. So he went back and said, well, what are they going to do to me? So he went and mowed a clearing down to the water's edge, which created a place for the alligators to come up and sun themselves instead of being hidden in the vegetation. So what's your take on that story?
Well, that is almost 100% correct.
Wow!
And the only difference is that what it was a lady.
Okay, a lady, not a guy. All right.
A lady who said she was very afraid that alligators would be lurking,
yes,
hanging out right along the edge there, right. And she wouldn't be able to see them, and they would come up and attack her.
Okay.
And the other thing, of course, is that in reality, the homeless association gave in to her.
Oh, okay. They capitulated.
And she and they went down, and they removed all the plants, uh-huh. And the next morning, when she came out, there were probably about four or five alligators laying on the bank with a full view of her home and her backyard. And then that afternoon,
yes,
she called the Homeowners Association and said, please put the plants back.
Well, that's even a better story.
Okay, so you worked with the Neighborhood Environmental Stewardship Team, and it was really only you. It wasn't a team.
Exactly. Correct.
But you were teaming with IFAS and other property owners, right?
Yes, and when I would go to meet with the homeless associations, when I would stand up there in front of them and talk about the program, mm-hmm. I would end it with saying, and oh, by the way, you guys are the team. I said, I am your coach. Uh-huh. You are the team. Whatever you want to do on your property to make it better, then I will help you with that. I'll show you how to do it. I'll show you where you can get the resources. I'll help you get a grant through the county programs. But you have to want to do this. This is not something the county's going to do for you.
What kind of grants would people apply for?
Virtually all kinds. Primarily the ones that I've dealt with mostly were people who had erosion along their stormwater ponds. And this would be situations where it had been going on for years. And of course, one of the reasons they had the erosion is because they wanted their lawn maintenance folks to mow down to the water's edge.
Yeah.
And as the erosion continued, you know, and they didn't know what was going on, then I would get called out to talk with them. And so I would meet with them and tell them that, you know, if you're going to continue, I guess I would use the phrase, if you're going to continue to do what you're doing now, then you're going to continue to get what you've got.
Yeah.
And I said, now, if you're not happy with what you've got, I can help you. And so we would sit down and they would learn the value of the vegetation and why the vegetation planted in the water along the bank as well as on the bank was good, because it would remove nutrients. The water would get clearer. They would actually have fish, that kind of thing, in the pond. And in the end, they would really appreciate what I had told them. Another thing that I worked with that was kind of interesting was with Pelican Cove. They had some issues where they had a lot of big trees on site, and a lot of their concrete sidewalks were breaking up. And they were asking...
From the roots.
From the roots.
Okay.
Right?
The roots of the trees.
And I explained to them, I said, the reason the concrete's breaking up is because the oak roots are having to come to the surface because they can't get air and water through the concrete. And they said, well, you know, what else can we do? We need the sidewalks. And it just so happened that I had been out in the Rocky Mountains and had done some hiking at some of the national parks. And one of the things that I noticed that they were using out there on the trails was a product called FlexiPave. And, of course, FlexiPave, for those who don't know, is literally a combination of materials that end up where it's very much like the rubberized material that they use in parks where the kids are playing. And the thing that's nice about it, it's very durable. You can actually pour it like concrete, and it allows water and moisture and air to permeate through it. It's very permeable. So if you use that as a sidewalk, the tree roots will not come up because the water and air and everything can permeate through the FlexiPave. So they said, well, gosh, we'd like to give that a shot. So that's what they did. And to my knowledge, it's still been a success after all these years.
So a lot of stormwater retention ponds that were built a while ago have water quality problems. And so what was your prescription for stormwater ponds that had water quality problems?
Well, the first thing we would do is... that actually led to the banning of fertilizer mm-hmm. during the summer months mm-hmm. when it was raining. Mm-hmm. And when we explained to them, you know, that what was happening, that was an issue. That was creating issues in the ponds that were preventing everything from growing the way it should. And then we also started to introduce plants in the ponds mm-hmm. that would take up the nutrients. Mm-hmm. And then some places wanted to try out some floating islands. Mm-hmm. So we would work with them on that if they were interested in doing that. And, of course, it's some people may know, a floating island, the concept is that you have a island of some kind that you can put holes through, usually wood from that perspective, or it can be any matter that floats. And then the plants would be planted through that material so that all the root system was down in the water. And so what would happen is... over time, that material would soak up all of the nutrients out of the water. You would bring the island in, transplant new plants, mm-hmm. take the old plants out, plant them along the shoreline, and just continue it, and the water would get cleaner.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and, you know, that's been an issue. We had a New College alumnus who did research on water hyacinths pulling nutrients and out of the water column. And if you'd actually remove the water hyacinth, then you're removing the nutrients. If you just spray them and let them sink to the bottom, then the nutrients get released again.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things that the county's doing now is that many years ago when I was working with the county, one of the maintenance guys, a guy named Roy, I can't recall his last name right now, but he was head of the maintenance program. And he was asking, can we get a harvester to remove all of those floating plants?
Yeah.
Because, as you just said, we know they're going to clog the pipes. Yeah. We know they're going to die. They're going to release the nutrients back into the water.
Yeah.
And now they actually have a harvester. After all these years, the county finally got around to buying one.
Oh, that's great.
So
we did a study, I guess it was for NOAA at New College, right? And we live in the neighborhood up near the Ringling Museum, and we found, I don't know, how many, six lots maybe, and two had a lawn service, and two the homeowner mowed and fertilized if they felt they needed to, and two were just sort of wild, you know, a typical Sarasota lawn that's probably 20 different plant species, and you just mow it periodically. And so what we did is we buried buckets in these lawns, and we had a student that as soon as a rainstorm finished, they were to go out and collect samples from these different buckets. And what we found was that the lawns that had the lawn care companies had greatly elevated nutrient levels compared to the other two, which doesn't surprise us, but it was nice to see it documented. So yeah, that when you're fertilizing a lawn next to a retention pond, you're also fertilizing the pond.
Very correct.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things that I always really enjoyed as the being part of the NEST program is that I was working with folks, another team of folks, who we were putting together the low impact development code at that time. We'd been asked to do that by the county commission.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Merriam was in charge of that. He was the manager at that time. And we put together a very tremendous number of good suggestions that if developers would follow, it would be easier for them. And one of the big ticket items was just like, you know, you were saying, Jono, that the standard way of development is to go out, strip the land, take all the topsoil, get rid of it, then put in all your infrastructure, then come back in with the most compactable soil that you can, because you're going to be putting sidewalks and roads and houses on top of it, and you pack it down where you make it, you're using the worst soil you can find to begin with. And then secondly, you're compacting it, so you're making it as impermeable as possible. And then you put sod down on top of it after you've put an irrigation system in, because you're going to need that irrigation system since the rain can't percolate into the ground very much. And then, of course, then you also are going to have to fertilize it, because the grass cannot get down into a soil where it can get nutrients for itself. So one of the things that I used to tell people when they would hire lawn care people is I said, you have to remember, a lawn care company is kind of like going to a doctor who treats your symptoms, but they never cure you. And I said, if a lawn care system can come out, put in an irrigation system for you to water your plants, and then fertilize it, what you're doing is you're training your grass to have its root system very near the surface, because that's where all the water and nutrients are coming from. And I said, and during the summer, it's going to bake in the sun. The grass is probably going to die from that perspective. And then they will come back out and they'll put in new sod for you. So I said, what it comes down to is that they have you as a patient for life.
Right.
Yeah, you're addicted to sod.
Right.
Yeah.
And I told them, I said that if you would, you know, basically not irrigate your yard so much, allow the water that comes off your roof to be going onto your yard instead of, you know, onto the driveway and then out to a storm drain, I said you wouldn't have to irrigate as much. And eventually the roots in the grass would start realizing the nutrients are down below, and the root system would get deeper, and it wouldn't die during the summer. And then you wouldn't need your lawn service quite so much. So that was one of the things that I always made a point of suggesting to people.
So we gave our parents, who lived in a new subdivision on the south side of Sarasota, a citrus tree. And it was a small citrus tree. And we had to dig through 3 feet of muck.
Well, more like marl and subsoil.
Yes.
Yeah.
3 feet of fill.
In order to get down to soil that could accommodate the roots of the citrus tree that we had given them. And, you know, that was really eye-opening for us.
And we used to, something I would do with students at New College is we'd get two or three shovels and get a group of students out and just dig a hole and see what they learned. And, of course, it was great exercise because most people, the deepest hole they've ever dug is like 18 inches to plant something. Well, we'd get these students out there digging a four-foot deep hole and seeing all the, you know, the different layers of soil and see the moisture content increases and they get to the hard pan and just a lot of learning going on there.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things that we had suggested in the low-impact development code was that when a developer went in, if they're going to strip off, I mean, first off, we tried to talk them into saying the best thing you can possibly do is not strip the land. Keep the trees, work around them. And one of the phrases that I came up with is that a friend asked me once, they said, how does development work? And I said, well, development works in two ways. You can either build within nature, where you work with the land and you work with the trees and you work with the soils that you have there, or you can build on top of it. And I said, and unfortunately, it's easier to build on top of it. But one of the things that we had suggested to them was that when they did take all the topsoil, would be to pile it up somewhere on the subdivision, and after they had put in all their utilities, put the topsoil back down, then put the grass down, and life would be much easier for the property owners who were going to be ending up with that property someday.
So it sounds like while you were working, the NEST program emerged, then there was the summer fertilizer ban. Both of those were kind of unique in the state, right?
Yes. As I said, it was surprising to me because I actually got phone calls from all over the country, and I actually got a phone call from England one day from people who were with government agencies who were thinking about doing the same thing that we had been perfecting and wanting to know how we did it, what we were doing, you know, can you give us some help? And I was just amazed. I thought, well, yeah, you know, I mean, whatever we can do, we'll do. But it was just amazing that little Sarasota had become kind of a hub of environmental, you know, knowledge.
That was probably back in the Shannon Staub and Thaxton days, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Those were the days. As I said, I was very pleased and shocked that, you know, the county commission said, you know, we need to do better. And here is your task.
Well, after the break, maybe we'll talk about whether Sarasota County is going to do better on stormwater management.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The Friendship Knot Quilt Guild is dedicated to preserving and promoting the art of quilting through education, community projects, and exhibitions. This nonprofit organization brings together quilting enthusiasts to share techniques, inspire creativity, and support local charitable initiatives. As part of its mission, the Guild presents the Quilts in Paradise Quilt Show on February 28th and March 1st at Robarts Arena in Sarasota, showcasing heirloom and contemporary quilt designs. More information can be found at Friendship knotquilters.com. That's friendship, K-N-O-T, quilters.com.
Yes, and Julie and I, we were up at the Florida State Fair this weekend, and every year they have a exhibition hall with woodworking and quilting, and some of the quilts are just incredible. If you've never been to a quilt show, you should check it out. And I wanted to mention that the city of Sarasota is presenting Shredstock, a drive-through document shredding event, Saturday, March 15th from 9 till noon in Van Wezel parking lot. City residents, so this is for the city of Sarasota, city residents can bring up to 4 boxes of personal documents and file folders for secure disposal. Staples and paper clips are okay, but CDs, DVDs, plastic, and those 3-ring binders, that's not going to work. More information can be found by calling Central Records Division 941-263-6108, and maybe we'll see you at Shredstock on Saturday to have a big shredding party.
So I want to move on to your role as the conservation chair of Sarasota Audubon. And you gave some great testimony at the hearing last Wednesday about how the new construction north of the celery fields is affecting the wildlife in the celery fields. So please tell us about that.
Well, that's something that we found over the years. Ackerman Park Lake, or pond, whichever you want to call it, was really kind of a canary in the coal mine, if I can use that phrase, for what was happening in the celery fields area. And what we noted was prior to any kind of development going on there, there was habitat that the birds would use and other animals, of course, in the area. And also, it was like a first stopover for migrating birds. You would always find flocks of ducks and various other types of birds on that pond. And then one day, after they had been approved, the land started to be cleared. And you had all the heavy equipment that goes into doing that, you know, bulldozers and, you know, all kinds of different equipment out there. Very, very noisy, very, very construction site information and noises. And what we found was that over the space of about 4 years, the number of birds during the bird count in that area was decreasing and decreasing and decreasing. And what we found was that as construction continued, it just became less and less. So first was the bulldozing and clearing of the property, which removed all the habitat to begin with. And then second,
this was upland habitat.
This is upland habitat.
Okay.
Yes. And then the area they came in and, of course, put in all the roadways and that kind of thing. Then they came in and actually started to construct the apartments that are there, the 4-story apartments. And so over that time frame, literally for the last 4 years, up until I think they finally opened sometime last year, you had noise, construction, people, equipment, just all the things that go along with building on that site. So one of the things about birds that a lot of people don't know, and again, I'm not a bird expert, but I've learned a lot being with Audubon for the last few years, that when there are loud noises, it disrupts the ability for birds to talk to each other. Because the songs that we hear and the chirping and that kind of thing, we don't understand what they're saying. But all the birds know what it's you know, chirp, chirp. There's a dog over there, chirp, chirp, there's food over there, you know, that kind of thing. So consequently, when they can't communicate with each other, they have got to go someplace where they can. And they've got to go someplace where the lights don't disturb them at night, and they've got to go someplace where you're not going to have dogs and cats and people constantly walking through their area. So it ended up where over time, Ackerman Lake just became devoid of almost any kind of birds. You would see things from time to time, but never the groupings of birds that you saw. So again, one of the things that I mentioned to the board the other day was saying that even the new administration center that they have been building and are not quite done with yet has had a very disrupting effect on the upper lakes. The two big lakes that are just north of Mount Celery and just south of the Publix area. When Publix went in, when the new administration center went in, when the other apartment buildings went in, all of those just disrupted everything. Because when you think about it, water, unlike some of the other parks that have mature trees, where you've got sound buffering because of the forests that are there, the Celery Fields doesn't have any forests. All you have is water and flat land. So literally what was happening is all that sound was traveling across the water and just making that whole area really not suitable for any kind of wildlife. And if you go out there today, the only thing you're going to find roaming around is the occasional bird and occasionally an alligator. So, in fact, I was out there just the other day walking there because I wanted to see if you could actually walk between the Celery Fields and the Publix area to see if anybody would be able to come that way, but there is a canal in between. So, yeah, one of the things that I wanted to bring up was the fact that if we continue to have development move in closer and closer and closer to the Celery Fields, whether it was on one side of the lake or the other, or one side of the road or the other, it was going to have a major impact on the viability. And, of course, as we all realized over the years, once the Celery Fields were built, no one really expected anything at that time than just a stormwater facility. And then suddenly all the animals and all the birds were like, hey, look, somebody built us a habitat. So we've been able to take advantage of it for all these years now, and we want to make sure it stays there.
So there have been, is it the Christmas bird count that,
yes,
that documents the bird use in the Ackerman pond?
Yes. Yes.
And so you've seen that those species mixes decline to almost nothing since the construction began.
Correct. Yeah. And honestly, I have not seen anything, even what I would call normally local birds, mm-hmm, hanging out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ackerman itself is probably the most rectangular pond in the county. And it's, as you say, because it was carved out of the Celery Fields, it's not like there was an oak hammock or a lot of native big trees around there. And then, so for people that haven't been there, when you go under the interstate on Fruitville Road, you'll see development on either side. But the development on the south side is just a strip or a band that's only so deep. And then almost immediately, The westernmost is Ackerman Park, and then there are the two cells, the two northern cells of the Celery Fields. And so all three of those lakes have seen a reduction in bird use as a result of that strip next to Fruitville being developed.
Very, very correct.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate because, as I said, I'm not blaming the developers because in most cases I would say they're probably ignorant of that having any impact at all. They just found a piece of property that they could use. The price was right, and so boom, all we needed was another Publix.
I didn't realize that that's where the county administration center is going to be newly constructed.
Yep.
So, what was I going to say? I lost it.
So the commission voted 5-0 to not approve the Smith Farm D D.R. Horton Conservation Subdivision. Is that correct?
Well, actually, it was just that was just a rezone.
Right.
Okay, it was rezone.
Yes.
Okay.
Right, so they own a farm that is five or six different parcels, and they could right now build, I think, four residences on the land, and they were seeking permission to change the zoning so that they could build 126 residences, which would dramatically increase the value of the property. And I expect, apparently, they had a contract with D.R. Horton that if the rezoning went through, that D.R. Horton would buy it from them.
Yes, that's correct.
So right now, the Smith family is in a situation that they could come back and say, well, how about 122 houses or 120 houses or 80 houses or 60 houses or 40 houses? Like, they have a lot of, it's not over is what I'm saying. They will have some response, and the county will have to decide how they're going to react to that.
That's very true. But I think one of the things that the county has realized is after the recent flooding was that as it stands now, even though it's not county property, that 50 acres did a very good job of soaking up and holding a tremendous amount of water, which lessened the amount of flooding that we had in the neighborhoods around that area. And that if we were to go in there with, I mean, literally any building that would take place in there, whether it's roads, sidewalks, or even, you know, 5 or 10 homes, would still lessen the area that you have to hold the stormwater. So it would not be a good idea. And again, because it's in a flood zone, you're going to have to bring in fill, and those houses would be like on little ant mounds. So it's a scenario where building in that area is not a wise thing to do.
So there were many photographs of the entire, well, virtually the entire site flooded. And the question I asked the commission that no one bothered to pick up on was, you should have staff explain to you that if this project was built like this, where would the water that you see in the photograph have gone in this second scenario where it's all developed? It has to go somewhere. It's not going to evaporate. So it's got to be displaced. And, you know, the big scale lesson from all this goes back to Hurricane Ian. What we've learned is that every drop of water that enters Charlotte Harbor in the Myakka Basin has to go through Northport. It either goes down the Myakka River, Deer Prairie Creek, overland. Northport is like, it just stretches across the bottom of the Myakka watershed.
Or the Big Slough Canal.
Or Big Slough. And so the same situation applies there. There's a lot of land north of Northport that's still agricultural. And so it's not great for cows, but that land can tolerate, whether it's 6 inches of water or a foot of water, if that had been developed and that water had been displaced in Hurricane Ian, if it all had to go through Northport more rapidly, they would have had far worse flooding. So they're tremendously fortunate that there's so much undeveloped agricultural land upstream of Northport. Conservation land, both ag and conservation, Myakka River State Park and the Carlton Reserve, they're all contributing. In fact, at one point, Northport even proposed building a reservoir on the Carlton Reserve just to hold back, you know, flood water. So, we should be setting aside all these flood areas. What drives me crazy, and we've had Steve Swa on the show, the county says, look, we've got a great strategy for up to 10 inches of rain in 24 hours. We're covered. We know we'll allow this much on a road surface and this much on a lawn and blah, blah, blah. But there's no plan B. If it's 12 inches, they've got no answers. And, of course, what happens is with a tropical storm, a tropical depression, you could have rain for several days in a row with a storm sitting out there. And so you could have 5 inches the day before. Well, then if you get 7 inches the next day, everybody's in trouble, even though you didn't get 10 inches in that particular 24-hour period. The system doesn't reset itself every 24 hours.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the things that I'm hoping the county's going to do is look at revamping the codes that they're going by. I mean, yes, it is better than most other counties in the state of Florida. They've done a very good job, but that was put together back in 1992. So, as we all know, things have changed. Whether you believe in, you know, whether it's the climate or act of God, whatever you want to say, things are changing, and we've got to adapt to it.
Well, what the realization I came to is we're like a quarter of the way through the 21st century. You know, we're using these 20th century approaches, and we're already a quarter of the way through the 21st century. It's, you know, time to step up a little and get with the program here.
Well, and again, that's why I was saying earlier that I think that I heard a county employee one time, fairly high level, who made a statement that there was no, this was just useless land, and that you're not making it meet its full potential until it has a building on it.
Wow.
And I bit my tongue and didn't reply on that. But I think one of the things that we really need to do is start thinking about the fact that open land, especially open land that has vegetation on it, you know, large trees and that kind of thing, is incredibly important, as Jono just said, you know, for maintaining our lack of flooding.
Yeah.
That as we, the more, every time any of the land gets covered with something that's impervious or developed to the point where the soils that are there are impervious or not very permeable, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And I'm hoping that we can change those things. And as I said earlier, I'm really hoping that, you know, that because of all the things that we saw this last year, that we will sit down and start looking at how do we make this better? How do we decide when a piece of property comes in for a rezone? If it's in a flood zone, I mean, if a quarter of it's in a flood zone, it may be okay. But if half of it is in the flood zone or more, those are properties we need to just say, sorry, you know, you have a farm or a ranch, and that's what you have. And whoever wants to buy it, that's what they're buying. And this is what you've got. Because we can't afford to continue going along like we're doing out east of us, out in the old Myakka area, where we're literally taking land that has always been farmland or open land and now putting in a tremendous number of homes and a tremendous number of, you know, streets and everything else. And then they're saying, we've got this crossover for the animals or we've got this whatever. And, of course, another thing that I personally find very disheartening is that when they come in for rezones and they talk about properties, one of the first things that happens is they look at reducing buffer zones, because under the current codes, you're supposed to have 500-foot buffer that's open land around your subdivision. And virtually everyone that's going in now is in a scenario where they have said, well, we've got farmland on this side, so that's open land, so we don't need a buffer there. And we don't need a buffer over here that's 500 feet. Let's just drop that back to 50. And, in the front, we're planning on putting in some businesses along the road. So we don't need a buffer there.
Yeah.
Until eventually you have no buffer. And they said, oh, but we will put this little trail of green through the community for the animals to get through.
Are there any plans for the celery fields to plant trees and shrubs around some of the ponds?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, the pond that would be almost across the street heading east from where the new fire station is, all that stuff is being built,
uh-huh.
That one is going to have some trees around it.
Okay.
And I think one of the things that we've been talking about, too, is the idea that, you know, if by some chance the Smith property were to become, you know, available somewhere down the road, and the people, whether it would be one of the things like, Big Water Land Trust, for example, mm-hmm. whoever would move in there and want to purchase that property, the idea of planting some additional trees in that area, not like a whole forest, but, you know, clumps of trees and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you maintain the openness of it, but you also allow for more habitat mm-hmm. is something that I'd like to see happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to check the numbers when I get home, but I believe I've found that Sarasota County has the 10th lowest millage rate in the state, which is, you know, what your taxes are based on. And I looked at the 9 counties that have lower millage rates, and 7 of them have more protected land than Sarasota County. So Sarasota County, according to the Florida Natural Areas Inventory, is 33% conservation land. Well, the counties that have the lowest millage rates in the state, 7 of them have more than 33%, and the average is 50%. So I don't know enough about the causality, but it certainly suggests to me that the more natural conservation land you have in the county, that's positively correlated with lower millage rates.
You're absolutely right. In fact, one of the things, too, that I feel like needs to be redefined is properties where they're talking about a conservation subdivision.
That's right.
As you were talking about.
Yeah.
Because I think that anyone who knows what the word conservation means, it means to preserve.
Yeah.
So by calling yourself a conservation subdivision where you don't actually preserve the land, it's kind of an oxymoron. And of course, the other thing, too, is that we have had so many revisions to the 2050 code and also to the Unified Development Code that have been kind of almost like a walk-on scenario as far as getting the change made. Oh, we just want to change one word. And what it comes down to is that where it would say, thou shall do this,
right,
now it says, if you feel like it, you can do it.
Might do this.
Correct. Yeah. So as I said, and those have come through without the public even knowing that it's taking place. They all think that these lands are protected by, you know, information and codes that were written under the 2050 plan. And they're finding that, no, now the code has been rewritten in order to allow the development of this area to be whatever the developer wants to do. In fact, one of the things that I thought was very interesting is that over my career, I worked on the regulatory side for almost 20 years. And I do not ever recall having a developer or anybody else who was needing something out of the code be able to come in to a county commission and say, the selections that you have available now are not something I can use. Therefore, I will come in and rewrite the code for you so that way I can do what I want to do on the property. I have never in my life seen that happen before. But here in Sarasota County, that's what we did.
Yeah.
We allowed, you know, Lakewood Ranch to come in and pretty much rewrite the codes to say, I don't want a village, I don't want a hamlet, so let me put a whole new category in there for you.
Yeah. We need to reclaim our public process. You know, during COVID, they started having all these Zoom meetings, and now we're stuck with these neighborhood workshops that are being done by Zoom, and they're just a complete disaster. We need to get back to having meetings, real people reading in public, and when the hearing's over or the workshop's over, then the rest of us can go out in the parking lot and talk about what we want to do about it. We can't do that. When they do a Zoom meeting, they don't even allow the chat function, so you can't talk to the other people that are attending the event.
Yes, it's incredibly disheartening from that perspective because, you know, when I was working with the county, that was one of the things that I loved to do, was to go to the public meetings where there might be a couple of hundred people and answer their questions. In fact, when I remember after I retired, I went to one county or one actual public meeting that the county had at one of the public libraries. And the idea was is they wanted to, there was a developer who was going to develop three subdivisions near each other, almost like in a triangular design. And what he wanted to do, well, let me back that up. When it was put forth to the public, it was said that a citizen wants to do this particular change in the code. And when they proposed it, they said, well, we want to take away, instead of having each subdivision have a 500-foot buffer around it, we want to get rid of all the buffers in the middle and just have one big buffer around the outside. And I raised my hand and I said, so if you don't mind my asking, who is this citizen? And they said, well, we're not allowed to disclose that. And I said, yes, you are, because it's all public information. And finally, they hemmed and hawed, and they said, well, it's such and such development. And I said, well, A, that's not a citizen. And B, you know, why should they do that? How is getting rid of those interior buffers helping them, the people who are going to be living there or the people who live around it? Can you explain that to me? And they were just like, No. And I said, so the only person benefiting by this change would be the developer himself, because he'd be able to put more houses in there. And they were like, yes. So myself and, you know, two or three hundred other people, you know, kind of stood up and said, I don't think that's what we want from this. So
there is a planning commission meeting on Thursday at 5 p.m. At the county administration complex on Ringling Avenue. And the applicant has a property in along Curry Creek, which is east of Venice. And they are proposing an extension of conservation subdivisions throughout the county through a comprehensive plan amendment.
Yeah, bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they are. It is an oxymoron. So we got to go, but how would people, if people are interested in joining Sarasota Audubon, how would they get in touch with Sarasota Audubon?
Well, the easiest thing, you can go online and look up Sarasota Audubon. It'll give you the phone number, you know, to the Nature Center. And this time of year, it's open most days from, I think it's open from 10 to 5. So that would be the best thing to do. Or drop by the Nature Center.
That's great.
Great idea.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton or listen online.
Today's show, number 56, featured Sarasota Audubon's Conservation Chair, Rob Wright, talking about Sarasota County's NEST program and Sarasota County's activities, including their work at the celery fields.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment. This is a great place to look back at the topics of recent shows.
Next week on March 4th at 9 a.m., you can hear the Healthy Living Hour with Dr. Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on March 11th for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota. And coming up on February 22nd, that's Saturday, is a group called Billingsley. So if you're a Billingsley fan, you need to check in. There's other events. You can find them online.
Stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's